Well, thank you, Vice Chancellor, for that kind introduction. It's wonderful to be here in beautiful Cape Town. I love South Africa and love South Africans and the hospitality from the University of Cape Town has been so warm and kind. Restorative justice is about restoring victims, restoring offenders, restoring communities. It's about the idea that because crime hurts, justice should heal. In my part of the world, and in South Africa as well, an increasingly dominant form of restorative justice involves putting together a restorative justice conference. And that's done in a way rather like this, although there are many variations depending on what level of the criminal justice system a restorative justice conference is set up. So in a common way of doing it, a restorative justice facilitator would speak with the alleged offender and ask the offender who they would like to be there to support them during the ordeal of the restorative justice conference. And likewise, the victim will be met with before the event and be explained that the offender has been encouraged to bring along the people that are most important to the offender in their life, and it won't be good if the victim is there without also having a support network. Those two communities of care then come together, discuss who has been harmed, who has needs that need to be met as a result of this crime occurring, and then together they will draw up a plan of action, which will usually be signed by an agreement by the alleged perpetrator, signed by the victim, and things will be agreed to be done. Often there will be follow-up conferences to ensure that what is agreed is actually done, and sometimes there will be a celebration conference to celebrate the fact that reintegration, embraced back into the community, has occurred. So it's a different philosophy of who's assembled in the room. In a criminal trial, those in the room are, in a sense, those who can inflict maximum damage on the other side. In a restorative justice conference, those in the room are those who can offer most support to their own side, be it the victim's side or the offender's side. And that's been an important move, the research has suggested, away from dyadic one-on-one victim-offender mediation. For one thing, it muddies the imbalances of power in the room, so that in the offender's support network and the victim support network, there will be both adults and children, men and women, more and less educated people, and so on. There will still be imbalances of power, but they will be rendered more complex depending on how good a job the facilitator has done at encouraging a diverse support network around the key players in the conference. Now let me tell you a story of what seemed like a pretty disastrous conference, one of the first conferences that I attended in rural New South Wales. Arrived at the conference with the facilitator, and this was a conference relating to a 14-year-old girl who, with a number of 14-year-old girls, was a pretty big-time burglar in this town. They were really totally cleaning out houses, which was not something that we think of 14-year-old girls as doing, but they really were. When we arrived at the conference, the girl's mother was arriving and protested that she didn't think it was a very good idea that this be dealt with in this way. The facilitator said, let's just try to see how this works, and if we all make an effort, we may make some progress here today. And she looked terribly unconvinced, and indeed, when we walked into the room, her 14-year-old daughter was there waiting for us to arrive, and Mum said to her daughter, "I'll kill you, you little bitch." Excuse my language. To which Mum replied with something slightly more appropriate, like, "Hi, Mum," and we sat down. Well, we were barely into the conference, just a couple of minutes, and Mum was up and pointing finger at her daughter, saying, "This is a load of nonsense. She should be punished," and stormed out of the conference. And after which there was a long silence, and I looked away across to the facilitator and said that our innovation, our criminal justice innovation, is really working well, isn't it? But actually, it turned out to be a pretty good conference in the end, because all of these victims came along to the conference extremely angry, wanting to really hit hard against this girl, and in this new context revealed about the nature of the relationship between she and her mother, and her father didn't come at all, there was a new kind of empathy for the condition of living that this 14-year-old found herself in, and it was revealed that she was refusing to live at home with her parents. It became clearer, although this was not gone into in detail, that she was suffering abuse at the hands of both of her parents. This turned out to be a shock to aunts and uncles, and indeed as sisters to a degree, who were assembled for the event, and a homeless child was found a new home to live in. There were offers from her uncle and her sister to come and live with them. She wasn't going to school. An important part of the agreement, the victims became less concerned at compensation for their loss of property from the burglary, and happy for the insurance company to take care of that. In any case, the child didn't have much to offer them by way of compensation. There were some gestures of compensation, but the important part of the agreement, and the part that gave the victims the greatest sense of satisfaction and closure, was actually persuading the girl to return to school and to stop living on the street with her burglary gang. Restorative justice is also about a shift from the model of responsibility in our criminal law, which is the passive responsibility model, to an active responsibility model. Our criminal law is based on the idea that we hold people responsible for things that they've done in the past. Restorative justice, in contrast, is about the idea of inviting people to take responsibility for putting things right into the future. It's about active responsibility as a virtue. I feel like there's a kind of a virtue ethics coming in at this point. But it's a future oriented conception of responsibility, where not all of the responsibility rests with the perpetrator. Responsibility is also actively taken in that story that I told by the aunts and uncles and sisters who offered to take the 14-year-old girl into their home. They felt that there was something that they could do to repair the harm, seeing it as a sort of a family responsibility, and not just going into the future, and not just a backward-looking responsibility that should be fully imposed on this child for the burglary, and a whole set of new and unexpected problems that had to be investigated in other ways. Clifford Shearing from the University of Cape Town, in his work, which has been an incredible inspiration to people working on restorative justice and trying to think about a more holistic, open textured way of thinking about justice, the Zwelithemba project that he and others led here in Western Cape. One of the many useful conclusions it came to is that what people were seeking in the 1990s, which was the period in which this project was at its height, was justice as a better future. That when you talk to people about what's the most important aspect of justice that they wanted, after the rich deliberation that was involved in the Zwelle Temba project, and that's a key point, what they wanted more than anything was justice as a better future. The better victim empowerment works in restorative justice, the more that victims manifest that priority for justice as a better future. If you don't empower victims very much, they're more likely to opt for a punitive form of justice. And in a sense, Clifford Zwelle Temba work was in a continuum with work that his former colleagues at the University of Toronto. Clifford was for a long time was director of the Centre for Criminology at the University of Toronto, and part of their program of work was about showing that the more information that participants in a justice process had, the less punitive they become. So that in one simple experiment, for example, if you show a random sample of citizens a newspaper report on a criminal trial and ask them what's an appropriate sentence for the offender to get, they will come up with, on average, a considerably more punitive sentence than the court came up with. If, on the other hand, you give them an edited transcript of the same trial that the judge sat through, they will come up with more or less the same penalty that the judge came up with. If you give them the richer sort of engagement that as well a Temba project or a restorative justice process of some other form offers to the, where there's a lot of process control in the hands of all the participants in the justice process, they will be less punitive again. And they will be more interested in the Shearing vision of justice as a better future. And justice as a better future is in part a way of thinking in an inspiring way about the South African story of post-apartheid, of post-conflict justice. Active responsibility is also about a Republican conception of citizenship, wanting to argue, as Clifford Shearing also argued in his work. Now, the Republican ideal is about freedom. It is about freedom as the most important political value. But it's a different sort of conception of freedom from the liberal conception of freedom. Republican freedom is about the ideal of freedom as non-domination. So it's an earlier tradition of freedom that sort of predates the rise of liberalism and is very much grounded in that long era of human history when slavery was a dominant institution, starting with the way the Greeks and the Romans thought about slaves. So that the Republican ideal of freedom is quintessentially the freedom of not being a slave, the freedom of not being dominated by others. It's not that liberal conception of the freedom to buy more stuff, of the freedom to have more consumer choices. Afrikaans political traditions, at least on my limited reading, is of a more Republican rather than liberal kind, a more social democratic than liberal tradition, in a sense that the Afrikaans political traditions that are deeply embedded in this society were more influenced by the 17th century Dutch Republic than Holland itself is today. Ubuntu is a communitarian ideal that also fits the ideals of republican freedom and republican empowerment that is a foundation for freedom based on engagement of each with every other. We are not born democratic. We have to learn to be democratic, and schools are very important places where we learn to be democratic. So your reforms here with respect to justice for children are the important place to start, and restorative justice in schools for dealing with daily problems such as bullying in school is very important. Increasingly, those of us who are engaged with the social movement for restorative justice have come to the view that we perhaps made a mistake in thinking that the criminal justice system, to try to reduce the rate of imprisonment by replacing some of the punitive justice in our society with more restorative forms of justice, was perhaps a premature leap. And the more important emphasis is to work at restorative justice in schools so that we have a new generation who experience, through their personal experience of learning to be democratic citizens in schools, see, taste, experiment through their own power to engage with their colleagues at school with restorative options as alternative to punitive justice in the education process. But at the end of the day, I guess restorative justice is about this republican vision, that starting from seeing Western societies as jaded, losing the momentum and interest in electoral politics, citizens feeling more and more remote from their elected representatives, both the executive branch of governance and the legislative branches of governance seeming a very long way away from something that ordinary citizens might want to engage with or have an opportunity to engage with. But when we are a victim of crime, when one of our relatives or neighbours are a victim of crime, and when we are nominated to participate in community problem solving through a restorative justice conference, it's a form of participation that it's hard to say no to. We feel honoured to be asked to support the young person who lives next door to us, who has nominated us as an adult in their community who they would trust to be one of their supporters. So it becomes a lever for a kind of democratic engagement that is increasingly being lost in Western democratic societies. So the ideal that the judicial branch can be the kind of the engine room for re-energising democracy and republican values of engagement and non-domination much more than the executive and other branches of governance. The evidence increasingly is that it can also, restorative justice can also help make the judicial branch of governance more effective in its job. In terms of crime prevention, there are some mixed results, but the important result is that overall, in the meta-analyses of more than 40 evaluations with credible control groups of restorative justice innovations, we've done a number of randomised controlled trials in my hometown in Canberra. The effect size in reducing subsequent criminality is not huge overall, but it's statistically significant. But it's particularly strong with more serious crime and with violent crime. So it works best with violence. So For mine, there's a real connection with our peace-building work that, therefore, I think it follows that restorative justice has an important place with peace-building as well as with crime prevention. In the experiments that Larry Sherman, Heather Strang did with us in Canberra over a 10-year follow-up, you have about a 40% lower reoffending rate among violent young adult and juvenile offenders in our jurisdiction. So this means that restorative justice does provide us with an option for a society in which there is less punishment and less crime, and therefore more freedom as non-domination. Because to put someone in prison is an act of domination. To be a victim of crime, especially to be a victim of violent crime, is to be a victim of domination. The South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission was a restorative justice watershed. It had many strengths that have inspired us in some ways, in similar ways, in other and in different ways, from the inspiration that we received from Clifford's Zuela Temba projects. Many strengths, also many imperfections, and I don't want to summarise them today. I want to focus on one criticism that I might advance of the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It couldn't deal with all of the healing that needed to be done with so many victims in just 3 years. It couldn't deliver all of the support services that were needed for so many victims of so many terrible crimes with so many to process, so many things to do in 3 years. And I think that's been an unfortunate thing, that so many countries have copied the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, saying we want closure, we want 3 years, and then we want to move on and get over get on with building justice as a better future. That seems to me not the productive way to think about justice as a better future. I actually think that a permanent Truth and Reconciliation Commission is a good idea. Why? Because the worse the atrocity that a victim has suffered, the longer they take to be ready to step forward and engage in a conversation to record their memory for the collective memory of the nation, if they want to meet with their perpetrator to do so, if there are questions about where loved ones' bones are to be found that they are finally ready to ask. They should be. That should be their right to be able to ask that whenever they are ready to ask it. And so the ideal of a permanent Truth and Reconciliation Commission is that even when all of the victims have died out, it's worth preserving the institution, even if the institution at that stage is no more than a repository for a museum. I've learned a lot from the Bougainville Civil War, which was a separate civil war separating Bougainville from Papua New Guinea. They didn't have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I've argued that it probably would have been a good idea if they had had one. But what they did have instead was a long-term, decades-long commitment to reconciliation processes at the local village level. One reason that that's important, that we learnt from Bougainville and have now seen in other cases, is this. There's always a big geopolitical story about what a war is about. That's the big story that we read in the newspapers. But when one's on the ground doing little local restorative justice processes in the aftermath of the conflict to deal with trauma that perhaps 10 years on still has not been addressed, what we find is that the conflict in this locality, in a particular locality, in a village society has very little to do with the big geopolitical story of the conflict. It's about this chief taking his community into the conflict on one side because it's an opportunity to settle a land dispute with that chief that's been going down the road that's been going on for a very long time. Sometimes it's about settling the score on a matter like sexual infidelity between leaders. Sometimes in Bougainville about sorcery that's gone back for a long time. Even cases that went back to World War II, where on Bougainville there was incredible fighting between Japanese and US forces, and some chiefs took their people onto the Japanese side and others on the American side, and there were atrocities that were never reconciled, and they're being reconciled today in the aftermath of healing from their civil war of the 1980s and 90s. In Timor-Leste, they did have a truth and reconciliation, which was a rather effective one in many ways. There, like the South African case, there was great disappointment, and for good reason, with the failure to prosecute as many of the most serious offenders as most people felt should have been prosecuted. They ran to safety in Indonesia and were protected from prosecution from the most part. There were 87, 88 criminal conviction, but most of those were minor offenders who were Timorese. One of the interesting things about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was it was in some ways a bit like yours, in that the president, Shanana Gusmao, when he received the report, was unhappy about various aspects of it, wasn't quite what he expected in certain regards, just as the ANC found it not quite what it expected in certain ways here, and he initially refused to publish it, and then after that refused to table it in the parliament. But one of the good things that happened as a result of all of this argy-bargy about what would happen with the report, that sort of an infrastructure of the Truth and their Truth and Reconciliation Commission kept going on for quite a while and kept being an active player in the polity. And they had a problem which is very common in post-conflict situation, where you had a networked transformation of power that was led by a civilian resistance on a very wide front, and then the leadership sort of shut the network down and power was centralised in a few leaders of the insurgency who basically ran the country. The UN was sort of comfortable with having just a few men who they could do business with, and most of the women in those civil society networks was excluded for power. But the Truth and Reconciliation, their commission, played a role as a check and balance in that new dispensation, criticising failures to re-empower women, that the women who made such a great contribution in the struggle for the liberation of Timor were now being sidelined, and that was not an example of justice as a better future, and the government should be called to account for that. And of course it is that problem of revolutionary leaders, of insurgency leaders who sweep into power with great authority and who command great respect, and certainly people like Shanana Gusmao and José Ramos Horta and the other leaders, the small group of leaders of Fretilin, deserved a lot of respect. They were inspiring leaders, great strategists of how to go about the business of liberating their country from oppression. But that resource, of course, in the hands of a deft practitioner of networked power, concentrated power of taking over the state can be, in a sense, more dangerous than in any other set of hands. So it needs special kinds of checks and balances, would be the argument that I want to put forward. Your Truth and Reconciliation report discussed justice as a better future. It discussed options such as a wealth tax, options that in that case were not followed through. I had a conversation yesterday with Charles Vincenzio about the idea of a permanent Truth and Reconciliation Commission, whether it would have been a good idea for South Africa. He said, you know, another alternative, John, would have been to retain the peace accord architecture nationally and the local peace committees, and that would have been another way of moving down that path and maintaining an infrastructure of both ongoing reconciliation, ongoing collection of new truths, new resources to contribute to the collective memory of the nation, and also this checks and balances options that I want to put on the table as a different way of thinking about justice as a better future. One of the functions when Truth and Reconciliation Commissions are established as interim commissions could be to propose how it could monitor the ongoing accomplishment of peace with justice. Justice as a peaceful society with reconciliation, justice in land distribution, access to health, justice in access to justice, eradication of crime and corruption, poverty eradication, etc. Perhaps there could be 10 of these or some such number, and every year the Truth and Reconciliation Commission could produce a report on one of them and whether the successor state is succeeding or not on that dimension of delivery of justice as a better future. And every decade the Commission could produce a report on whether overall there has been continuous improvement in peace, reconciliation and justice, including social and economic justice in the society. So the idea of a permanent Truth Commission is partly about the separation of powers as the most important feature of Republican political architectures. For post-conflict societies, TRCs could be constitutionally entrenched with a small but significant function in a richer separation of powers. At the moment when a conflict ends and a regime falls, it's a sort of a Rawlsian moment where the political players are in more of an original position than they are at any other moment. That is to say, the incumbent power holders are going out the door. So they're willing to be fairer than they would normally be when they're clinging to the reins of power. The successor forces are jostling for positions. No one knows. Everyone knew here, I guess, that Nelson Mandela was going to be the first president, but no one knew at the moment of transition, before ballots had been held and so on, whether his successor would be Thabo Mbeki or President Zuma or Cyril Ramaphosa or any one of a number of other people might have been credibly thinking that they might have been the successor president. So they don't know whether they're making ground rules which will be protecting them from their political opponents, or whether they will be imposing on their political opponents. And that's what we mean by it's a more Rawlsian moment where uniquely societies are able to have a constitutional moment where something better is put in place constitutionally. I certainly think South Africa is a case of that. And in many post-conflict dispensations, we see mandated representation of women in parliaments and all sorts of things that were quite impossible at other moments when, for example, men are clinging to power. Constitutionally independent anti-corruption commissions, a constitutionally truth and reconciliation commission, or National Peace Council, that's a watchdog of the independence of the anti-corruption commission. The early South African republics in places like Orange Free State were, you know, had these social democratic and republican elements committed to eliminating white poverty. The 1994 Republic was social democratic and redistributive in its vision as well, committed to eliminating poverty among all races. South Africa is an inspiring light on the Republican Hill. South Africa's constitutional moment, when it can do really radical institutional redesign, may have passed for now. But one of the best ways the whole world can honour South Africa is to learn from the inspiration of your constitutional moment how other countries can use their future constitutional moments at the end of their civil wars to build even more radical separations of powers that check the state, check powerful corporations as nations struggle along their journey toward justice as a better future. That's the essence of the Republican vision of deeper freedom, a freedom from poverty and corruption that might prevent future wars. Thank you.